Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Tangential Banter. My name is Ben Mowell, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Jack Korzenowski.
Ahoy there, y'all.
Jack's typical greeting, as usual. And today, we have a special guest with us, a friend of mine from college, Sammy Sales.
Good evening, everyone.
So we are looking forward to tonight. We got couple topics picked out that we're going to jump into. But before we do that, Jack mentioned as we were getting started that he wanted to get back to our topic from last time, talking about driving etiquette. And apparently, Jack, there's something you need to get off your chest.
There is. And not only is it something I want to get off my chest, but I always attributed this, what I would consider bad driving behavior, just to Iowans being bad drivers. But I think there's actually a reason why Iowans specifically do it. But before we get into that topic, so Mr. Sam, do you go by Sammy or Sam?
Most people call me Sam.
Okay. Ben, should we just introduce him to everybody? Or should there be an air of mystery of who is this mystery man? Where did he come from?
So I can give a little bit more background. And then I guess, Sam, you can introduce yourself how you'd like, whatever you'd like the audience to know. But we met at what at the time was called Purdue Calumet in Hammond, Indiana. So a lot of people don't realize Purdue is actually a public school. Indiana has a lot of different branches, just like a lot of state schools do. And so we were at Purdue Calumet, which is the second largest campus, about 10 minutes west of Gary and 30 minutes from downtown Chicago, pretty close to Lake Michigan Lakeshore. And it's about the size of the University of Northern Iowa. It's a little over 10,000 students. Like I said, we spent a lot of time together in intramurals was primarily what we did. So we had teams, played a lot of basketball, football. I mean, I can't remember all the different things we did, but it was a fairly small campus community. So I felt like there was only a handful of us really that were kind of leading the charge, like participating and trying to create that culture there.
Right.
But yeah, feel free to add anything.
Most of my memories of us at college was either sports, but the funny thing is one of the reasons that I was drawn more so to Ben's is two people that I went to school at Purdue with, you and Donnie. I was always intrigued of how you all thought, like sometimes just simple conversation. I was like, yeah, you know what? I never thought that way. And so that's why when I have a certain topic or anything, I'll always ask you and Donnie, because I'm always interested in your perspective of things. But also too, just being, I'm a very non-combative, non-drama, all of that. And I kind of, I would guess, lean towards people who are also like that, like kind-hearted people. So I think that had a lot to do with it as well.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely, I think we both have a laid-back approach to life. And just, like you said, not non-drama. definitely true.
Definitely.
Especially in college, there could be moments where it was high drama. So it's good when you, like, when, like, calm recognizes calm, and you're like, all right, let's... Yeah. Just keep it relaxed.
Yeah. Let me stand next to this guy because he knows.
Yeah. And it's funny you should bring up Donnie. Jack also knows him. I've made the introduction for something else that we're working on. I have exactly the same perspective on the way he thinks, because like he has so many thoughts and he's very articulate in the way that he puts them together.
Yeah.
So he and I sometimes go back and forth on different things, and sometimes we take it super seriously. Sometimes it's sarcastic. It's always interesting, that's for sure.
Definitely. Wait, Dolly.
So,
well, cool. Sam, do you? I can't remember if you guys said. Did you go to school for engineering as well?
So that is a double answer. Technically, yes, but also no. My freshman year at Purdue, I was in engineering, and I quickly realized it was not for me. It I think in one of my first classes, I had to build a bridge, and it took 17 pages just to calculate like 1/4 of the bridge. I was like, no. And then we had to build like the wooden bridges.
Yeah.
And my bridge, he barely set it down and my bridge fell apart. So I was like, this is not for me. But also too, to be honest, and this is with all due respect, I always wanted to be an engineer for the prestige of it. But every engineering student that I knew was miserable throughout college. Like, you could just walk past them like with a blindfold and you'll know who the engineering student, because like they're grunting and their demeanor was just, I was like, man, I definitely don't want to be here. So but then I switched to computer graphics technology, so henceforth I'm a designer.
Okay, that's cool. It's good that you found, well, it's sad that the schoolwork is what turned you off of it, because one of my biggest complaints about like engineering school in general is that what you do in the class is like all that heavy math and all those calculations. You never do that in the actual field.
Really?
Never. Very rarely. And certainly not to that extent.
It's like learning how to make a spreadsheet by hand just so that you can learn how to use Excel. Basically, is right. What engineering school does too. And once you start using Excel, you're never going to go back to a paper spreadsheet. So, yeah.
Huh. Or it's like you're like you go to school for cosmology. Is that the one that you look at the stars, or is that the one? No, yeah. Or is that the one where you do makeup?
Cosmetology is
cosmetology.
Cosmetology. Okay, so if you go to school for cosmology, and you know, like you're gonna be looking at the stars your whole life. If you had to do a bunch of classes on how to design a telescope, not using a telescope, but how to specifically design it, and it's good background information to have. But you're never gonna design a telescope as a cosmologist. That's not your job. Sort of what it feels like. Where you learn a bunch of good background information, and a lot of it you need, but you're not actually doing what you do in school after you get the degree.
Yeah.
My whole life has been a lie.
Welcome to college.
I literally was like very excited about being an engineer until I saw
It's more of like just a barrier of entry, right? Like, I think it's a way to weed people out, and it doesn't really turn out that way for most of us, I don't think.
Well, I guess that worked.
Yeah. I have a lot I can say about, and I'm sure Ben and I actually have said a lot of things.
Yeah, about, we've talked about that before.
Yeah, but that's not what we're talking about today. So as Ben introduced, I do have an addendum to last episode's topic. I'm not gonna make it too long because I do want to focus on today's stuff, so I'll just get right into it. One thing that I noticed right away as soon as I started driving around in Iowa after moving down here is that when people are merging onto a highway, it's like they don't know what to do. Like if I'm in the right lane and I'm driving and I see somebody on, you know, an incoming on ramp and they're like immediately to my right and they're matching my speed. Yeah, I'm from Minnesota, and they actually know what to do. They'll say, oh, there's a car there. I'll either slow down and get in behind them, or I'll speed up and get in front of them. Not Iowan drivers. They will just stay pace with you until the very last second. I've seen people merging lane, after it merges into the highway, they'll just keep driving on the shoulder and not speeding up or slow. Wow. It's like they don't know what to do. It's so consistent. And I, for years, I was flabbergasted at how bad these Iowan drivers are when it came to merging. They just don't know how to merge. A few months ago, I had an incident where a guy was merging and he almost like merged right into me. And I was like, no, screw this. I'm going to stand my ground. So like I had to like honk at him and he finally like slammed on his brakes and then got in behind me. It's like, what are you doing? You've seen me for like the last 15 seconds.
It's probably like a factory or something just producing people coming off into that on the on ramp.
I feel like the two things that come to mind for Iowa drivers in particular are that change is hard. So if you got that cruise control on already, it's like, oh man, I don't want to shut that off to go speed up or slow down. But also, you're so used to there never being traffic anywhere. I think a lot of people just genuinely don't check. But they're so used to there nobody being there, they don't bother.
So there's...
Or it's the car factory.
Is it that feels like they're robots that have no sensors indicating whether there's a car there or not. But here's what I found out just a few months ago. In fact, it was after I was talking about this incident with someone, and then this is when they what they told me. So I grew up in Minnesota. I got my driver's permit and my went through driving school in Minnesota. Sam and Ben, where did you guys go to driving school?
Indiana.
Okay. And Ben?
Yeah, Michigan.
Okay. So none of us took driving school in Iowa. When I was talking to this when I was venting about this incident, the person said, "Oh, well, you're supposed to get over." I'm like, "No, you're not. You're supposed to, as I was taught, if you are on the highway, you have no obligation to make to yield to the person merging onto the highway. They have to yield to you." And they said, "No, in Iowa, you are supposed to, if you can, move over when you see somebody merging."
Well, those are both true. Those are both true. You are supposed to get over if you can, but it's the obligation of the person entering the highway to merge make that work. You have no obligation as the person already in the lane.
If you want to be courteous, sure. But I know when I was in Minnesota, they taught you as the merger have to yield. The person in the right lane on the highway doesn't have to do anything. They made that very
clear.
That's
just a common courtesy.
Yeah, common courtesy.
But it's funny you'd say that because I've noticed, we didn't talk about this last time, I think there is something legitimately different about the instructions that Iowa gives drivers. And I hadn't thought about this last time until you mentioned it now, but I've never seen so many people pull into the farthest lane while making a turn as I have in Iowa. Like in Michigan, that was a big deal. You're supposed to pull into the first available lane so that like if somebody's coming the other way, you can like both make a turn at the same time. And I just never do it here because you would get T-boned every time you make a turn because people take the wide turn into the second lane.
Yeah, where like if there's two left-hand turn lanes, somebody will be on the left-turnmost one, but then they'll cross over into the right-hand lane somewhere during the turn.
Really?
Well,
they're really bad about that here. I'll agree with Ben.
They won't stay in their lane while they're turning, but then also, like, let's say you and I are both going to turn east, but I'm coming south and you're going north, right? So we're, like, opposing traffic. And you're turning right. Like, in Michigan, it's reinforced that you can both turn if there's two lanes because you're both turning into the lane that's closest to you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But in Iowa, people will go to the second lane. So they'll, like, either cut you off or T-bone you, pretty much, if you're going into that lane on the turn. It's
bad.
It's very consistent behavior that I've noticed. And I've also had people tell me that is correct somehow.
That can't be.
Wait, that is correct.
There's no way. Like, I believe that they told you that. But I don't believe that they knew what they were talking about.
They claimed that's what they were told in driver's ed. The one instance where I've seen it work is, like, where you can't... If you turn into the first lane, there's a car that's coming and you couldn't get up to speed fast enough to where you would impede or you wouldn't impede their driving. But you can cross the lane and get into the second lane and then accelerate in the second lane.
I can understand the idea.
Why they do it. Yeah, I get the idea, but it's definitely not correct.
But they'll do that when that description that you just said is like, that seems to be like in this particular scenario, then it's okay. But I've seen people just do it willy-nilly.
Right.
And they're just in the car in the other lane.
Right, when they're like going to cause an accident.
Yeah. And it's gotten so bad where if I'm in if I'm in one of those dual turn left or turn right lanes and there's somebody, you know, parallel with me, I will be very, I don't know what the word is, aggressive at defending my, because I'll match my lane. I won't cross over one way or the other. But if I'll be very aggressive at making sure that if I'm in the tighter turn, so if we're two lanes making a left, if I'm in the left-hand one, so it has a smaller radius, I'll make sure to be slightly in front of them so they can't cross over and cut me off. And then if I'm on the further out lane, so I'm in the right-hand left turn lane, if that makes sense, I'll also move my, so you know, it doesn't matter. Either way, I'm going to move myself so I'm in front, slightly in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
Or ahead, I'll put ahead of them, not in front of them. I'm not trying to cut them off, but you know, I'm further up in my lane.
So
than
they can,
there. So
yeah,
they can't, if they want to merge, if they want to cut into the other lane, they have to impact me. And then I get free money.
Free money.
They have to impact me.
Not just in like a metaphysical sense, in a very right. physical sense.
That'll teach them.
The other thing I was thinking of, Jack, and I don't know if you've noticed this coming from Minnesota, but there are so many unregulated intersections in town here, and it freaks me out because in Michigan, I had never experienced anything like that. I don't even remember it in Indiana when I was at school, but you'll come up to like a, in a, why can't I think of the word? Like a neighborhood, residential neighborhood. Yep. So it's 25 both directions. In Michigan, one of the directions would have a stop or a yield sign. It would be mm-hmm. obvious that like one direction has to yield to the other. In Iowa, there'll just be no signs. It's a free for all. So like everybody comes to the intersection. And I think the intent is that like, because there's no directions, you have to slow down and figure it out. But what ends up happening is just everybody assumes it's there right away and then just cruises through. And I feel like it's just this terrifying situation waiting for an accident.
Yeah, we do have those in Minnesota. They're pretty rare, and they're in similar areas as I've seen them here in Iowa. And I've only seen them here in Iowa in one neighborhood in Cedar Falls. But I also, you know, I don't cruise the neighborhoods of our town very often. I'm just looking for, hey, what are you doing tonight, Jack? Oh, you know, just in a, just cruise around looking for unregulated intersections.
Hoping to get in a fender bender.
Have you ever seen unregulated intersections, Sam? Do you know what we're talking about?
Yeah, in some neighborhoods in Indiana, but mostly everything is, has a stoplight, stop sign, yield, or something. But with the Illinois drivers, none of that means anything.
so true.
Honestly, within the last couple of years, anytime you see somebody run a stoplight or a stop sign, they have Illinois plates. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. It's funny when you're driving on the highway out here, you can tell what, you don't even have to see the plate. Somebody will blast by you on the highway. Guaranteed it's somebody from Illinois. They're just hauling.
I really want to know, what are they teaching them in driving school? Or are they?
Is it the prominence of Chicago? Because I know Chicago's traffic is infamous.
I think so. To be honest with you, like when I stop and take my bias outside of it, I think it's really just a lot of times you're a product of your environment. And, you know, Chicago being so many people, so cluttered and everything, you just develop different mm-hmm. mindsets and skill sets. And everybody thinks it's Talladega Nights for whatever reason.
Well, you kind of have to sometimes, because even if you don't want to drive all that aggressively, if you get on the highway and traffic is flowing at 90 miles an hour, you don't have a choice.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
That's definitely true.
I think that's one of the things that, like, when you come from a rural area where people tend to follow the traffic laws pretty precisely, that's one of the things you have to adapt to is, like, okay, you become a hazard if you're that stuck on the rules, like, there's got to be a balance when there's a bunch of other cars around. It's all about keeping people safe, including yourself. So that means adapting to what people around you are doing.
Yep.
But there's also a lot of driving that I've seen in my hours and hours of Chicago highways that had nothing to do with adapting to people around them. It was just people trying to go somewhere fast and not paying any attention.
I try to avoid driving downtown Chicago if I can. My wife and I went to a comedy show last weekend, and the minute I leave the comedy show, I'm in my car and I'm getting back to Indiana as fast as possible. I have to get out of there. It's just nonsense.
It's stressful too, I feel like, because the streets are so narrow and
Taxis blowing nonstop for no reason.
And then there's just all of a sudden a pothole in the middle of nowhere that'll
that wasn't there 2 seconds ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh man. Yeah, Iowa drivers are a special breed, that's for sure. Yep.
Well, that's okay. All I wanted to cover for that topic, just my frustration with Iowan drivers' lack of merging capability, but also delving into the possible reason why, because they're expecting people to get over, which is a very bad, I was thinking about it analytically, I'm like, if that's how they're teaching things in Iowa, then one car can disrupt a total of three cars in two lanes of traffic. Because if there's somebody in both the right and the left lane, now the right, this happened to me, like where I'm driving, I'm coming up, I'm about to pass somebody in the right lane and they quickly cut me off because somebody's merging. So it's like, buddy, you just interrupted me because some guy to the right of you is merging. Like, no, just like keep your pace up and it's on them to get behind you. So that's the danger. It's very inefficient and it's dangerous because you're interrupting three people instead of one.
It's true.
So if you're in the audience listening from Iowa, take note. Okay. So I think we want to transition now, and given the amount of time we have, I think we'll just switch to our main topic for today, which was one that you had proposed, Sam. So I don't know if you want to introduce it or I can, but
you can go ahead. You can go ahead.
Okay. So I think that you said it slightly differently, but the general premise was, is the view worth the climb? And I think you had mentioned specifically work-related topics or like the corporate world, climbing the corporate ladder sort of thing. But for our purposes, we can certainly talk about that or expand it however we'd like. I was thinking about just life in general, whether it's any kind of achievement, whether it might be athletics or academics or, even things that we do, kind of hobbies or what we do in our free time. I think there's a lot of applications for us. I'm kind of interested to see where the conversation takes us, but certainly like to open the floor for you to maybe give us your thoughts on what brought this to mind or what's going through your head.
Yeah, so, well, actually the thought came from just looking at the economic turmoil that's going around. A lot of companies, given the climate, are laying off people. A lot of times they start at the top, executive level. And so it just got my mind to, my wheel spinning. Of all the things that we do from our life, like let's say you always wanted to be a corporate executive of John Deere, and you start, sometimes you're groomed from you being a child, you go to middle school, high school, college, and everything, every move you make is to get to that position. And then sometimes, in my personal experience, I've realized the height, the view is never worth the climb if my motives are wrong, no matter what the achievement is. I've found out there's a lot of things that I've desired so badly, do whatever it takes to get it. And then once you have it, it's like, what now? What do I do now? And then sometimes it brings about despair because now it didn't satisfy you the way you thought it would. And so now sometimes we get to a point where you don't know what to do next. But I think I've started to change my focus, more so just trying to keep some sense of balance. Because no matter what you do, everything costs something. So me trying to be the best corporate executive or the best designer, oftentimes that costs me the time I have with my family. And so a lot of times I have to ask, is this worth what I'm giving up? And mm-hmm. sometimes I found out it wasn't. It wasn't worth it once I got there.
Yeah, that's super relatable. Sorry, were you going to say something, Jack?
Yeah, I was going to ask, when you say, it depends on your motives, and if you're doing it for the wrong motives, then the view will never be worth the climb. Can you quantify what you mean by wrong motives?
Yeah, so sometimes there's a lot of things that's going on. And in my opinion, in my experience, there's a lot of things that's going on inside of us. Like, and this may be real raw, but I found out after going to therapy later in my life that a lot of the achievements I was trying to do, try to be the best basketball player, try to be the best designer and get to this and get to this dollar amount, I was trying to prove to myself that I never needed my father. Mm-hmm. And so if he ever, I mean, I have an all right relationship with him now, but in my mind, I didn't realize in my subconscious mind that I was hoping for one day that he will see what I've accomplished, everything that I accomplished. And then some, you know how we create these narratives in my mind that he'll say, oh, you did it without me, and feel away, and then it'll make me feel better. But it never did. It nothing satisfied that. And oftentimes when it's motivated by anger, resentment, or childhood trauma, there's nothing. I think Will Smith once said that there's no amount of money, there's no amount of sex, there's no amount of anything that you think you want that will satisfy that trauma, that wrong motives. So a lot of times we want the accolades for the attention or for the glory or for the praise that we think we want. But those things really are, you know, forever fleeting. And I think anything that's like rooted in something temporal is oftentimes not sufficient for our desires.
Mm. That's good insight. And it's good that you discovered it. And because I would agree that if you something that you said really struck a chord, you know, everything has a cost. And I agree. I'd even go further to say that some things, or maybe everything, for sure has a cost. Mm-hmm. You are going to sacrifice something to pursue this path. Right. But they often won't have a payout. So trying to be the next famous musician or any artist, or trying to be an actor, you know, how many people gave up their life to move to Hollywood and you've never heard of them because it didn't work out?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Right. You always hear the rags to riches stories, mm-hmm, that are successful. You never hear about the rags to back to rags stories.
It's true. It's not funny for you.
It's easy.
Doesn't
to
quite have the same ring to it.
Exactly. It's probably why I don't hear about them. And so I think it's easy to say, if I just put all this work in, then I'll get what I want. It's like, no, the people who get what they, you know, the people who made it to the top put a lot of work in, but not everybody who put a lot of work in made it to the top.
Right.
And it's hidden. You can't see it. So I think this is a different topic, but I mean, it's related, but it is a separate conversation. But the point I'm trying to make is just the pursuit of the view could end up costing you more before you even, you may never even get the view, right?
Right.
You may climb and then break your arm halfway up or fall to your death off a cliff. So you did all the work, you gave up your life, and you didn't even get a view. So that's like the question. It's like, do you even get a view in the first place?
That's true.
And then once you get there, okay, was it worth the cost? So it's like this two-tier barrier you have to get through.
Yeah, it kind of, I think, maybe adding on to your last thought there, Jack, like there's no guarantee of the view, right? So it's not just, is the view you anticipate at the end going to be worth the climb? Because I think for a lot of people, they would say yes, or at least in their mind it is, but they're never gonna, the view that they end up seeing is never gonna match what they had in their mind. Mm. Whether it's due to being cut short or just due to, that view never really existed. It was just a, you know, like a paper tiger fantasy world kind of a thing that they had imagined.
Yep.
But
put it on a pedestal.
Right. And I think this really connected with me or hit home with me. And it ties in both with the metaphor and with the lesson. I went with my older brother and a friend of mine from college, Matt Hess, and his friend from high school. The four of us went together to climb Mount Kilimanjaro in 2014. And at the time, I was like, you know, I like kind of outdoor adventure travel sort of stuff. And I was thinking in the back of my mind, like, it'd be sweet to do the Seven Summits one day and, you know, checked it off the bucket list. And so we went and it was a great experience. I wouldn't trade it for anything. We had a great time while we were there. But what I realized, like, it was 5 days up and 2 days down. On those 5 days, we probably spent a total of, like, I don't know, maybe 15 hours climbing, something like that. And the rest of the time, we were basically sitting in tents, not gasping for air, but close to it, like trying to acclimatize our bodies to the altitude. So we were just playing euchre in the tent for like hours on end. And it was super boring.
Euchre, is that a card game?
Yeah, it's a card game. It's, I think, a Michigan, pretty Michigan-specific card game. But so anyway, what occurred to me is, like, I'm glad I'm doing this, and I'm going to enjoy the view from the top. But the lesson for me from climbing Kilimanjaro was, like, I have zero interest in finishing the Seven Summits. Like, there are other people that want to do it, more power to them. But that moment of standing on the top and realizing, like, what you've accomplished and looking out over the world wasn't worth sitting in a tent for a week playing cards to me. And so that was like, okay, I've learned something, right? That doesn't have to be a failure that I'm not going to do the Seven Summits. It's just like, yeah, it's not something that where the view would ever be worth the climb for me. And so I was able to take that, cross off the list, and just move on with life and enjoy it for what it was. So I think that's part of this, I would say, maybe mitigating the problems with the climb, is realizing where you have this picture built up in your head of a view that you want, and then realizing, yeah, that's not really what I want, or, you know, I'm not willing to pay what it takes to get there, and change to something that suits your priorities.
And actually, too, I was just about to say that, and that came to me as you were talking. Just in one aspect, we would agree sometimes the view isn't worth the climb, but in that regard, the view itself just helps you refocus and say, you know what, it's not what I thought. When sometimes you're almost to the top of the summit, and then you realize sometimes in some of these corporations or some of these things, the things that you have to do or the person you have to become to get to that view, you realize, no, it's not worth my peace. It's not worth me changing who I am and things of that nature. But I think in my experience, specifically in the corporate world, a lot of my goals as a designer in the corporate world was, a lot of times, and to be honest with myself, is just to be able to say that I work for this great company, this company that everyone knows. And then once I got there, it was like, my life didn't change. Like, I've worked with companies like DocuSign or Microsoft for, you know, things like that. And it's like, and I can tell someone, hey, I work with DocuSign. Hey, I work with Microsoft, but that doesn't change my mortgage. It doesn't change how much my kids love me. It doesn't change anything, really. And so I realized this corporate climb for me was no longer about working for a big name. And so then I readjusted. I'm going to use this corporate ladder to then build my own ladder, so then I can buy back my freedom, buy back my time. So now I can do what I want and spend more time with my family.
Nice. I had a similar experience, but I'll let Ben talk. But I just want to raise my hand and say I have a somewhat similar experience to what Sam was saying.
All I was going to say is that it's pretty wild how, I guess I would say that I think prestigious companies are aware of that effect that they have on people, and certainly take advantage of it, to where people are like tripping over themselves to do things or work harder or whatever because of that perceived accomplishment in their mind that they're not really being compensated for in any way. And for many of them, they are sacrificing a lot of things outside of work, which is really, on the one hand, it's unfortunate. But on the other hand, I totally understand it, because I think a lot of people go through life trying to figure out, like, what am I good at? What is my calling? What's going to make me significant? Whatever. And some people find that in work, and they really feel like, this is finally something that I'm really, really good at, and I'm recognized for being good at. And so that's highly motivational for all of us, you know, to be praised and rewarded for doing something that we're good at. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, right? Where you can make that praise and reward your ultimate goal, and then you just chase after more and more and more. And it, all that to say, I was reminded when you first introduced the topic of this sign I saw a few years ago at Jimmy John's, actually, which says the gap between more and enough never closes. And I just think about that in terms of like satisfaction and contentedness, you know, like if you can't learn to enjoy and truly relish what you have now, whether it's your job or your family or whatever, or your salary,
right,
you're not going to enjoy whatever you get next either, right? You're always going to be looking for the next level, the next fix kind of thing. But go ahead, Jack.
That deep kind of dive into, you know, more, you can never have enough, and you have to learn just to appreciate what you have. Did that deep of an insight really get inspired by an advertisement at a Jimmy John's sandwich shop?
Yeah, they actually have really inspirational signs on their walls. There's one, a similar one that talks about a story, and it's probably made up, right? But the story of this guy who was fishing in Mexico, which is like a Mexican nationalist out fishing, and some tourist is walking down the beach and sees him, flags him down, and asks him how he, you know, if he's catching fish or whatever. And the guy says, yeah, some. And the tourist says, he had seen him get started and it was kind of late in the morning. He says, well, you could probably catch more fish if you got started earlier in the day. And the guy's like, sure, I could. He's like, well, if you caught more fish, you could, you know, start a business and you could sell it. And the guy's like, well, why would I do that? And he's like, well, then you could grow your business and save money for retirement, whatever. And at the end of the story, basically the guy's like, well, you're basically setting all these goals for my life to have a job, save money for retirement so that I could live how I live now,
right,
only after like decades of toil. So it was just all about, you know, this kind of a parable of aligning your life priorities so that, you know, you don't have to, you know, rush through the rat race to achieve the life you want. You can live it now, if that's really what you're pursuing.
Yeah, Jimmy John's is deep.
check it out. I feel like they're probably standard signs. I don't think there's anything special about the location.
But still, the fact that they emphasize it speaks volumes. But so the point I wanted to bring up, Sam, when you said that, you know, when you started working for these, in your mind, like, you know, prestigious companies, and then you can finally say, I worked for company XYZ, but then you kind of looked around and said, oh, nothing's really changed. When I first started working at the company, as Ben and I refer to it as now, I really wanted to, even before then, I really wanted to work, like be an engineer for engines, because I thought engines were cool, like internal combustion piston engines and stuff. But long story short, a lot of the jobs are in industries I don't want to be in, but I found the company, which is agricultural equipment. I was like, how much more wholesome can you get than designing engines for farmers to grow food, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, let's go do that. And the first five roles I had at the company were all like, some of them sounded really cool, like on paper, like what you do. So what do you do? Say, oh, I'm an engine calibration engineer. So I actually control how the engine runs and make sure it's performing the way we want and meeting emissions. And it's like, as you describe it, it sounds really cool, but then you do the work, it's like, this isn't that fun. I don't really enjoy this job. Some of it I do, but a lot of it I don't. And a lot of my jobs are that way. It's like, you're the test engineer for engine components. You can do like fatigue tests on connecting rods and, you know, make sure our oil pumps aren't going to fail too early. It's like, that's really cool. And then the day-to-day stuff is not fun and not fulfilling. So I had like this, my job title and my role sounds really cool. On a high level, it's really cool. But the day-to-day stuff is, I wouldn't say miserable, but a lot of times I was not looking forward to, you know, going to work the next day. So then I decided, next job I look for, I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to look for a job where the day-to-day stuff sound like it is, sounds like stuff I'm for sure going to enjoy. You can never really tell because the day-to-day details are so foggy in like a job description when you're asking them in their interview. But I was very careful about what jobs I would apply for, even if the high level sounded completely boring, mundane, something I wouldn't be interested in. And I did that, and that's a job I have now. And sure enough, the subject matter could bore you to tears and is in no way as cool as saying I work on diesel engines for tractors. But the day-to-day stuff is so fun, and I look forward to logging on to work every day, and it's great. And it's like one of the best jobs I've had. There was one job working in engines where both things were good, the high-level stuff and the day-to-day, but it was just one out of five. And this one matches that for the day-to-day. So I agree with you where you need to realize that the stuff that you are actually going to be dealing with day to day, the in your face stuff really needs to take priority than just to be able to say, I work for this company or my role is X, Y, and Z. Because I've lived that myself and I learned the hard way that you got to focus on the day to day low level details.
Agreed. Also, too, I want to add on to what you're saying. Another, and this may only be my experience, but for anybody who don't know, I'm a designer, but also I design websites, I design collateral banners, social media, everything, do videos. And so a lot of times the companies that I've worked in, I've always worked in like the advertising or the marketing department. And the view that we're all chasing, it in a sense became really irrelevant to me when I started to realize most of the things that we're taught or told by society is really manipulation. And I'm saying this from a marketing standpoint. There's so much data, there's so much wordplay that these companies can almost guarantee what day you're going to go buy their product. Like, I've seen the numbers, I've seen the data, I've seen the strategies. And it's like these companies, Nike, Apple, their marketing departments and advertising departments are so brilliant. Whatever they want you to chase, they can almost convince you to chase it with colors, with words, with sounds, with, and it's like, my whole life is a lie. Like this That's whole crazy. American dream, a house, picket fence, 2.3 children.
Yep. Don't forget little Jimmy, point,
right, yeah,
point like, three of a person.
Once you see the back end of, I mean, it's not that the company itself was necessarily, you know, immoral. It's just more so once you start to learn the marketing tricks, is they really teach us in marketing advertisements how to manipulate human emotions.
Yeah, it's a bit creepy. Yeah, go ahead, Ben.
I was just going to say, I think that issue is something that's coming up a lot right now with the emergence of AI.
Yep.
Where this question of what is ethical to do in a business environment. And I honestly think it's pretty wild because as you described, the reality is it's psychological warfare, right?
Yes.
Like companies know what triggers purchases, what behaviors they want to incentivize, and they use like biochemical hooks essentially in your brain to get you hooked on their product and want to buy stuff. And so to me, it's one thing with adults. I think it's completely unfair because we as humans are not equipped to fight that battle, right? Like we're equipped to lose it, right? Like that's why it's so darn effective is because we lose a lot.
We don't even know we're fighting.
Yeah, we don't. We don't even realize there's something going on. We're just like, oh man, I'm really hungry right now. That's odd. Like, love a Coca-Cola or whatever. But what I've been thinking about is how it's one thing with adults. To me, I cannot comprehend why we allow marketing to children. Because as much as adults don't have a chance, children really don't. And the example I've been thinking about is like, you're walking down the aisle in the grocery store and you see, you know, like Pop-Tarts or some really sugary cereal or whatever, it's always got cartoon characters from kids TV shows on it, right? Yep. Like
colors.
Kids would, yeah, and colors, like the kids would never know to ask for that in and of itself if it wasn't being marketed to them with things that they already know and enjoy. It's like, oh, just add this into, you know, Paw Patrol or whatever. And it's just like that, it's not at all helpful in trying to teach the children impulse control or healthy habits or whatever, which, let's be honest, even we as adults aren't very good at. But no. Even when we try, we're being stymied at every turn by really the power of persuasive marketing.
Agreed. And I think, too, one thing that we, I mean, I guess in this particular conversation, we're been blessed or fortunate enough to be in positions where we can consider a job that we enjoy or a job this, but with a lot of the marketing and advertising that's done, the people who buy the most are the people who are oftentimes not in those situations. And what I mean by that, they're focused at people who are basically surviving, because a lot of times we knew, and when I was working as a sales manager at a car company, we just say a car company, we knew when a person came in when it had a certain credit score and a certain amount of income, they were wise enough to spot sale tactics. So we couldn't sell them on certain things. But the people in a different demographic, when they came in, we knew if they only could afford the Ford Focus, we knew we can convince them to buy the Lexus because they're impulsors. And so that's another perspective of once you get to the top or the pinnacle of certain industries, you start to see things of what they really are, and then you realize, I don't know if I want to be here.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of it too, where when you step back and look at it in the big picture, it's really pretty ugly and unethical in a lot of ways. But then when you're just in the day-to-day doing your job, we all like compartmentalize it so much that most of us are just going to our work doing things that we maybe would look sideways at if we saw someone else doing it, but it's just so much a part of the way that the world works. We can't separate ourselves and it seems normal. And so as a society, I don't really see those conversations happening of like questioning ethics and morality of allowing some of these types of behaviors to continue. They do. And that's my fear with AI, is that we're just going to stumble our way into significant changes to our society without really ever being able to evaluate the cost until it's too late.
Yeah. To me, I enjoy advancement in technology. I love like modern model things, anything human beings have built. But I feel like the AI topic is just like, we're progressing as a world as if we haven't seen Terminator, or as if we have, you know, we haven't seen iRobot or anything else. It's like, at some point, AI can be dangerous. And then we need to have some type of guardrails, some type of discussion on, okay, this is too much, or, you know, but it's like, we're just pressing forward with the gas.
Yep. I think that people being afraid of AI now is much like how people were afraid of the internet or any other technological advancement. And the thing is, that doesn't mean that being afraid is necessarily a bad thing or the incorrect thing. It's just, we've seen a lot of people crying wolf before, where this is going to destroy society, and, or it's going to, it's, or at least not destroy maybe, but degrade society. Like the internet's a great thing. It has its costs associated with it. It has some downsides, but it's got a lot of upsides too.
Agreed.
And I think AI is going to be something very similar, where it's easy to be afraid of it now when we can speculate and let our imaginations get the better of us. But I'm guessing it's going to end up being a better thing than bad. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, heck, the fact that the world hasn't blown itself up in via World War III with the advent of nuclear weapons, I think really attests to people aren't as willing to blow up the world as people are afraid they are. You're right, getting one bad actor that says, I'm gonna use AI to take over the world.
Somebody has some restraint somewhere,
right? I do think that decentralization of power, such as having all of the nuclear warheads controlled by one person, probably not a good idea. But AI is not going to be that way either, so that's good. The internet isn't that way. You know, one person can't just flip the switch and, oh, the internet goes down.
Yeah, it's all tools. It's just a matter of how you use it.
Yeah. I will say it's unfortunate that the deepfake stuff that came out like a few years ago and then AI are going to make all video records completely having video of something will no longer be proof of the thing happening because we can just make videos up now.
Yeah. And that's been that way for a while. People just didn't know it.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was going to say, because I do so much work with videos and corporations, that I tell people all the time, like, there's not a topic on this planet that I can go on my computer and create a video to convince you of anything. I can find the fake documents from Egypt. I can do just about anything there can be done and convince you of it. And that's why it's like you said, it's so hard to really know the truth nowadays because, you know, mm-hmm. technology is so advanced.
Yeah. And I think kind of tying back to what you said, Deck, to me, it's not a fear of AI. It's more of a, let's just think about what we're doing before we do it for a second.
Right.
Because like you said, it's easy to have this like Chicken Little mentality, the sky is falling, and imagine worst case scenario. And as you said, like, we haven't seen a nuclear holocaust yet, right? That doesn't mean it's not coming. It could still happen, but we've survived 80 years without that. Well, there were thousands of nuclear warheads around the world. So,
and might I add, during some very turbulent times where we really should have gotten into World War III, but by a miracle we didn't.
Right. So I think it's a fair argument. But on the flip side, I could say, like, if you look back at like 1984, George Orwell, right? There, he talks about having basically government screens and listening devices in every home so that every conversation is monitored and you're basically told what to think from these monitors. And I think it's hard to argue that that hasn't happened to a large degree with the internet and quote unquote smart devices, right? Where, and it's not necessarily because the government came and mandated it. We all said, sure, I want to be able to order soap just by voice commands, right? And so we've invited technology into our lives that has also made these like dystopian realities come to life, you know, whether it be like in Batman, is it Dark Knight, where Lucius Fox has that cell phone located?
Yeah, that's Dark Knight.
Yeah. And so it's like, okay, that's essentially not quite that extreme, but essentially that's what the government started doing with under the Patriot Act, right? And Edward Snowden and all that stuff. I think, in all honesty, like, I think Edward Snowden has to have been really disappointed with the response from the American public in responding to the revelations of what the American government was doing. Because he basically got ran out of town and life continued as normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he expected that people would rise up and be like, no, this isn't right. Like, we have a right to privacy and so on. But anyway, all that to say, it's not that I'm afraid of what AI or technology necessarily means. It's just that we never stop to consider the consequences. It's that quote from Jurassic Park that I mentioned last time, you know,
You're
so busy thinking if they could, they didn't ask if they should.
Yep. And I think that your explanation basically says what I meant more so. It's like, we need to take a pause and to reevaluate everything before we just go full speed with something.
Yeah.
Well, can we even really have this aside? Because the thing is, it's not like there's one team of people who are developing AI right now, who then can, you know, have like a conference, like a meeting in conference room J. Hey guys, should we really do this? Maybe we should put the brakes on this. Like, we should table it and think this through, and then we'll notify the world that we're going to just put AI on hold for a little while. You know, it's not just one person or one group.
It's not practical.
So how,
but that's how
I don't disagree that we should stop and like, do we really want to do this? But how, what would that look like given the global, it's like an industry-wide push. It's not even one company doing it, much less one group.
So that's exactly why professional organizations exist, right? Like, you think about, for example, like Society of Automotive Engineers, right? There's thousands and thousands of engineers around the world, probably hundreds of different companies and suppliers. They all work together, not as a single team, but they work to align to make sure that they're designing parts to meet certain standards. And so there are things that they say, this is what we deem is appropriate for the industry. So that's not to say it's right, but then if someone else comes along and decides not to do it that way, they really don't have a defense if, you know, something bad happens or whatever, they go to court. It's like, well, how come you weren't using the standard? Well, we didn't think, like the whole, that sub that imploded, right? Where the founder was basically arguing that getting things certified was a barrier to innovation, whatever. It's like, well, it looks really bad when your design catastrophically failed and five people died, right? Like, there's a reason the submarine industry has standards. So I think it is difficult, but I think all it would really take is, you know, say the top 8 to 12 leading minds in AI to start calling for a conference and to start calling for some kind of industry standardization and best practices. I think it would happen pretty quickly.
And I think to piggyback on what you're saying, I think in my mind, it all sounds good, like it should be, but I think with a lot of things, once they're too far gone, there's not much you can do about it. You can try to do conferences and things, but if they get too far, because just about every company that I use any software, like Photoshop has AI in it now. So Adobe or everyone's using it. So it's like the top 10 companies or top 20, they could probably start a conference. But like once everybody has their hands on it, it's, you know how the world gets.
Pandora's box, right?
Yeah, that's the sad thing about human beings in general. Once that box is open, it's hard to close it.
Yep. Yeah, and it's I can't remember what author it was, but he said that life is the art of learning to draw without an eraser. Ooh. And so you improve over time, but you never get to go back and redo any of the mistakes that you made previously. And so you can draw straighter lines, you can get more elegant, you can try to move in a better direction, but you still carry that past with you. And that's true for us as a society and as a species, even that, with a lot of these things, you only get one first shot at it, you know, and then from there, you've got to potentially correct for things that went wrong. So it's not to say we can foresee all ends and everything's gonna be perfect, but usually we just learn far more by trial and error than by trying to think ahead.
And I think too, and maybe I could be wrong with this, but I think in a lot of things, like a lot of documentaries I watch and things I study, a lot of times there's a person or a group of people saying, hey, this is this. And the mass majority of the people in charge is like, oh, don't worry about that. And then the challenge explodes, or then 9/11 happens, or then this is like, there are a lot of times there are people saying, hey, we need to button this up or button that up. And then it's not, you know, how human beings are. Until a plane crash, they say, okay, we need radar to make sure we're not going to a mountain, or we need this. So a lot of times, as they say, lessons not learned in blood are soon forgotten. That's a sad part of human society.
Yeah.
Two little points to that phenomenon, which I agree is unfortunate, but there's two obstacles to overcome. If you want to, two obstacles that I can see that you'd have to overcome if you want to fix that phenomenon or get rid of it. One of them is some things we just can't foresee until it happens. Oh, shoot. Yep. We didn't even realize we needed to protect against this. That's and true. That's unfortunate. But, you know, some learning is going to be through trial and error like that, particularly for the less intuitive, more niche problems. But then when it comes to, you know, people who are kind of trying to be whistleblowers, sure, every now and then you'll get a guy who is telling the truth. But for every one of them, you have like 20 or more people saying completely other bubkiss stuff. And so, guys, we wouldn't be able to have any planes in the air ever if we had to follow up on all of these claims or something. And so either it's you carry the risk or you don't engage in the activity. And it's not just planes. It could be planes, cars, the internet, right? I'm sure there was somebody who said, oh, through the internet, people will spread a virus to every computer in the world simultaneously and cause them to crash, and the financial systems will fail, and, you know, all computer-controlled systems will malfunction, and the world will blow up. Nukes will get launched. It's okay, buddy. Let's shut down the whole internet forever just to avoid that.
I think part of the hard part is that with everything so interconnected, we as individuals lose our ability to make a decision as an individual for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Because it's basically like to exist in the modern world, there becomes a point where you just have to accept a base amount of risk. Some of these technologies or risk or whatever it might be. Yeah. That it's like the only other option is to basically go live as a hermit on a mountain somewhere. Right. Like an example being like, think of how integral cell phones have become to our lives today. Sure. You cannot own one, but people are never going to be able to get a hold of you or never going to bother trying to get a hold of you. Mm-hmm. Right. So you're not going to get to go to birthday parties. You're not going to find out about events, like whatever the implications may be. That's essentially a fundamental connective tissue for everyone in our culture today.
Yeah.
And so even if you feel like, man, I really don't like, you know, the time I waste on my phone or whatever, you're still kind of stuck with it. And you can take steps to try to reduce that, you know, get a dumb phone or whatever. But it still has a significant impact on your community, I guess I would say.
Yeah. Oh, another good visual example of that is if you don't want to own a car, you don't have to own a car. But this country, the United States, was designed around the car.
Right.
So you are going to suffer because your environment around you was designed for this thing that you don't want to partake in.
Because of the risk, the perceived risk.
Right. Like if you're like, I don't want to drive a car because I don't want to get in an auto accident or any reason, really. It's like, okay, but, well, your life's going to suck in other ways now.
I guess you're going to walk.
It actually makes me think about one of the, I guess, dilemmas, you could say, for, like, organizations that do DNA testing for genealogies or whatever, and they've started, in some instances, using that DNA to solve crimes, which, in and of itself, I think is great. But initially there's just a lot of questions about, you know, what rights do you have where it's not even your DNA that is being submitted. It's distant relatives or whatever. And I think in a lot of those instances, like on paper, the only people who are being targeted are people who are believed to have committed a crime of some kind. But there's always just that fear of it being abused. And so if a brother or an aunt or an uncle or a cousin or whoever, anybody close enough to be able to identify me uniquely submits DNA, I don't have a say in that decision. And I just get stuck with it after the fact.
Hmm. You rose a good point, which I think is the foundation of all what fears I have with any form of technology, or not even just technology, power given to or otherwise obtained by the people who are, you know, the ruling people, the people in power already, is I don't like if genie like the ancestry or the genealogy companies collecting DNA and then the state using that DNA to solve crimes. I'm not in just right there, you know, off the cuff, not necessarily against that. What I am against is if they say, hey, we have this guy's DNA now, let's use it to frame him for something because he's been speaking out against the government. That's what I'm worried about.
I agree. I think most of us civilized people, and I put that in air quotes, our fear always comes from if it falls into the wrong hands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
And there's no, the hard part is there's no telling when or who those wrong hands may be.
Exactly. Right?
And so part of the, for me, the mindset that I have is trying to, because I'll say it this way, if I back up a step, the wrong hands could be me in 10 years, right?
Yes.
With the wrong motives or whatever.
Right.
And so part of the way to combat that is, I mean, Jack, you're talking about decentralizing power before. And I think it's decentralizing, having checks and balances, and just trying to prevent situations where someone could be tempted to use that power in an inappropriate way. So it's not that the power itself shouldn't exist or can't be used for really good things. It's how do we intentionally design structures that protect against that? And I think it's very necessary. One of the things that I listen to, I don't listen to a lot of other podcasts and stuff, but I do listen to one periodically called Wrongful Convictions. Mm-hmm. And it's just fascinating and incredible and depressing at the same time of just all these stories of people who spent decades in prison or were even wrongfully executed because the police or our district attorney or whoever got tunnel vision and like zoomed in on somebody way before they should have and excluded evidence and whatever, whether it was intentional or just because they were trying to, you know,
get a
conviction. Yeah. And it's just completely ruined people's lives. So it's for those who say, well, if you don't commit any crimes, you don't have anything to worry about. That is not
true. That's not true. It's not true at all.
It might be a small percentage of the population, but it is not true.
And you never know who that, you know, it could be us. Could be the person saying as long as you don't commit a crime, you don't have anything to worry about.
And what's crazy with those, too, is like a lot of them involve false confessions where police will interrogate somebody for 22 hours and just tell them over and over again, we know you did it. We know you did it. And people literally say, by the time they got done questioning me, I was like, well, they say they have video. They say I did it. I must have done it. I must have like blacked out or forgotten. And they've done studies that show basically definitively, even people who are aware of it and who think, oh, I would never admit to something I didn't do, in many instances can be basically pushed to sign a false confession just to get out of the room and to try to survive for another day. Mm-hmm. So
it's torture, basically.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was watching an episode of CSI like a few days ago where that happened, where the guy was like in a room for over 12 hours, no food, water, or sleep, and he just said, I confessed because I needed to get out of there.
Yep. And it's weird for me now because growing up, I was always taught to respect law enforcement and that, you know, they provide a valuable service to our community. I think broadly speaking, those things are still true. And for all of the faults that we have in our legal system in the U.S., there's still a lot of good things compared to other parts of the world. But on the flip side, there's still a lot to be improved, a lot to be desired. And we need to hold, right. We need to hold people accountable when they're not living up to the standards of justice that we have as a country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't take, it takes a small percentage of whichever party is meting out justice to be, it only takes a small fraction of them to be corrupt for their, I guess for the corruption to reach out wide and have big effects on the populace.
Right.
Doesn't have to be everybody. It can just be just one bad seed.
It can be one. Definitely true.
And what's really weird is I remember specifically in high school having a conversation with a teacher, and I was on the, like, well, if you don't do anything wrong, you don't have anything to worry about side of the fence, right? And now I'm like, man, after hearing how all these things can go wrong, it's like, I would really hesitate to be interviewed by the police about anything without having a lawyer there, just because mm-hmm. you never know what their intent is or how it's going to be used.
Yep.
You know, one of the frustrating things that I've endured, especially over the last couple of years, is this notion. By no means do I think any particular profession has better people or worse people, but we all can agree there are bad people in the world, right?
Mm-hmm. Not one. So, I've been having this whole conversation just as we're joking, right? Obviously, none of this is going to happen,
right? So if we know there are bad people in the world, some of those people are cops. Like, just by luck of the draw, some of those people are also cops. And so sometimes this narrative that because you're a law enforcement or because you're risking your life day in, that you must be morally correct all the time. When history has proven that is not true. History has proven that is not true. And so a lot of time, mm-hmm. especially in my community, I try to keep people from, oh, I hate cops. Like, no. Hating cops is like hating an engineer or an architect. That's just a profession. People are bad people. They make bad decisions no matter where they work. Mm-hmm. And then there's also good people. And it's just, like I said before, oftentimes our fear is focused on, what if this is a person that has power in their hands, but they're going to abuse it this time?
Mm. That's one of the things to me. I think it applies to law enforcement. I think it also applies to churches as well.
Agreed.
Is where you have a strong amount of influence and authority in the community, you have a moral obligation to hold your employees and your people to the highest standards. And there's this weird perception, I think, among some of those in law enforcement that if we air our dirty laundry, it's going to undermine the people's perception of the criminal justice system, or it's going to undermine, you know, the authority of the police. Like, no, hiding corruption is what does that. When you come out and say, hey, yeah, this guy was breaking the law, and even though he was one of us, it was wrong, and we're going to fix it. Like, that's what earns people's trust and respect. And it's not just like we were talking about law enforcement. I see that also with a lot of the, like, child abuse scandals and sex abuse scandals and stuff within churches. It's like, that's not something you push under the rug. That's something that you bring to light and expose it and own up to it, fix it, right, and protect against it in the future. But in no way does it enhance the reputation of your organization to cover up corruption or wrongdoing.
No, by no means. No. No.
Ironically, by trying to be perceived as trustworthy, they prove that they are untrustworthy. Right. And then vice versa. If we present this, they're going to see us as untrustworthy and say, okay, maybe in the short term, but if you do consistently come out and with your transgressions and are transparent, then you will, by showing, hey guys, there have been times where we have abused your trust, they will ironically trust you more because they will know that you're being transparent. And if there's a problem, you're going to identify it and fix it.
Agreed. And it's not just the trust of being honest. It's when someone comes forward acknowledging the ways that they wronged you, even knowing that it could be to their detriment, you can gain a respect for their honesty, but I think there's also, you realize that they can empathize and that they're repentant in some ways of what happened. And so it becomes not just truth-telling, but it's humanizing of being able to connect and go, this person realizes that they hurt me, and so they're trying to make amends. And so it's more than just that, the truth element. It's building a connection on both sides.
I did one point that I wasn't able to put in when we were talking about, you know, law enforcement and good cops and bad cops is, when I was younger, I used to think, you know, oh, how can people be defense lawyers and, you know, defend somebody they know is guilty? And I'm sure a lot of people share that sentiment. But like the last handful of years of my life, I've realized that criminal defense attorneys have, I wouldn't call it like the most important job in the country, but it's just like the potential of horror that they are like the last stand against is, I am having difficulty in expressing in words what I'm trying to say, where it's like the latent sleeping, hibernating danger that they are going to be the people who keep at bay is so unrealized by the American public, or just any public in general. Because it's easy to see that criminal defense lawyers are, oh, they're just people trying to make a buck by defending murderers and rapists, and they don't care about justice being served. In reality, that role, and maybe that's definitely true for some criminal defense attorneys, but the role itself is there so that the government can't, or at least to mitigate the risk of the government just persecuting people because you don't like what, because they don't like what they're saying against them.
That's fair.
The criminal is going to make this, or even just to prevent the state from, as Ben said, right, with some of those false convictions, I would bet most of those aren't because the prosecuting team knows that John Jacobson or whoever didn't commit the crime, but see, we just really don't like this guy, so we're going to try to frame him. That's not what happens. They're just doing an incompetent job at the investigation, and they get it wrong. The criminal defense attorney's job is to hold the state accountable for that conviction. If you want to throw this guy in jail for the rest of his life, you better darn well sure
prove it.
Cross all your T's and dot all your I's, and that you do things right. Because as soon as he starts asking questions and poking holes in his theory, then the jury can say, oh, maybe the state isn't doing that good of a job, and maybe they did get it wrong.
That's fair. That's fair.
They hold the state. They're the only people holding the state accountable as far as it comes to like criminal cases. They're the only ones.
Yeah, it's interesting that we, I mean, the state has the burden of proof. But we also only have a formal office for the prosecutor. There's no like district defendant or defender, whatever, right? We have public defenders, but a lot of times it's people, you know, it's pro bono. It's, there's questions about whether you're getting the most effort or the most competent people.
That's true.
But I think it all comes back to, what I like to remember is Blackstone's ratio, which was named after William Blackstone. And his statement was that it's better for 10 guilty men to go free than for one innocent man to be imprisoned, basically. And that's the principle behind that whole role, is it's not just a free-for-all where accusations throw people in prison and hope that we got all the bad guys, right? It's, no, we'll actually knowingly let people who are guilty walk free so that we have that protection for those who are truly innocent to not be jailed for something that they didn't do.
I think too, our society nowadays, especially with cancel culture, we actually do the opposite a lot, you know, outside of the justice system. A lot of times all you have to be is accused of certain things, and you lose your contracts, you lose your endorsements, you lose everything. And then oftentimes, even if you're proven innocent, your image is tarnished so bad that you never recover from the thing that happened, which I'm always against. Like sometimes they'll pull up a video of a guy rapping a rap song. He said the N-word and just, oh, this guy, like, whoa, slow down. Like, I don't ever, and I think Black Widow said this in one of the Avengers movies. She said, I don't believe in judging somebody by the worst mistake. And I think if we take the time to say, okay, if we're going to criticize this person by something he did 10, 20 years ago, we also have to dig up our past as well and be criticized just as harshly.
Yeah. And I think, honestly, that's why a lot of people are so quick to judge, is because they know that they have things that they don't want brought to light. And so it's like, as long as we keep the spotlight on somebody else, then I'll never have to answer for that thing I said or did or whatever. And also, there's a fair amount of, like, I'll just say virtue signaling, right? Where it's like, yeah. Well, if I'm the first person to call this wrong or to say, oh, he's terrible, then that makes me good because
right.
I said something bad was bad. It's like, that's not really how that works. But
you know, Ben, you brought up an interesting thing right there where you said people may jump on the bandwagon of persecuting somebody for a mistake just so that the spotlight stays off of them. So this is a comment about me. I actually would be more inclined to defend the person being persecuted for the very reason of, oh sure. Boy, if sure the spotlight's on them, but what happens when it turns onto me?
Yeah.
That's why I would be more inclined to say, guys, like put the torches and pitchforks down. Right, because as soon as the cancel culture faces you, do you really want the torches and pitchforks being, what's the word I'm looking for? Brandished in your direction.
Answer's and that's the no. thing is when you get on a roll like that with people who are just tearing things down, like they'll find something, right? Oh, it doesn't have to be legitimate. It doesn't have to have been bad. Even if you do have things that were legitimately bad. But it reminds me of, there's a meme I see periodically when it's like, oh, a coworker friends you on Facebook for your boss, whoever. And it's like, and it says underneath, a whole bunch of people are going to have to get cool with a whole lot of stuff really fast. That's what I feel like when you're that person trying to calm things down, that's in the back of your mind. Like, let's just be cool, guys. That also reminded me of a meme I saw earlier this week that tied into our first topic of, is the view worth a climb? And it was like, had two different stations. And one station was like, those who want to win. And the line was like out the door. And then the station next to it was those who want to do the work it takes to win. And there was nobody in line. And I was like, yeah, that's pretty true too.
As a counterpoint, the second station didn't say what were the stations like those who wanna or like
want to win?
Yeah, those who wanna win. The second station didn't say those who wanna do the work to win and also win. It was just doing the work.
I think yes, that's fair.
Maybe this is where now it comes full circle. He needs to get a marketing department in play. So he knows how to manipulate people into doing the work and winning.
Yes. And because I mean, to the point you made earlier, there might be all that work and no winning, so you don't want to be in that line.
That's true. So good on them. They're actually making this, they're basically making the decision that Sam advocated for earlier. Well, I'm not going to just do the work, so I'm not going to get the reward. Who would want to do that?
The problem we have, though, is that there's just so many people on this planet. Like, there are very few who are truly, quote unquote, winning in those categories, as you could define it, right? If you think about professional athletes or CEOs or whatever the top echelon of your chosen career path is, even if it's being a stay-at-home mom and you aspire to, you know, be an interior decorator and come up with new gourmet meals or whatever it is that you spend your time on. There's always going to be people who are quote unquote better than you at those things. And so you can still just burn your whole life away pursuing something that's never going to be within your grasp.
Yeah, actually to that point. Well, first of all, I don't think there's a definitive, you know, version of winning, but what I think that social media has mutated this idea of winning, because I have been on vacation with people and they're taking the pictures and making it look like they're having such a great time with their spouse. And every second they're not taking the picture, they're arguing. And so it looks like they're winning. It looks like they're couple goals, but in reality, it's nowhere near what it looks.
Yeah. That just makes me think of like social media in general, or any kind of like influencer, I'll say, kind of lifestyle. The case that comes to mind is a few years ago, I went to I was out in Utah for a wedding, and I went out a week early with a photographer friend of mine, and we visited all the big national parks, and we were at Arches for a day, and there's that delicate arch. It's the really famous one that it's on a lot of postcards. People like get their picture taken with it, and it is super beautiful. But when you get there, what you don't ever see in the pictures is that there's like this arch, but it's essentially surrounded by this natural amphitheater. And when we were there on just a random day, there were probably like 200 or 300 people sitting around waiting their turn to go like take a picture under the arch. And so, you know, it's like basically a line or a queue half an hour long just to run up there, snap a picture quick and run back out. So I sat way in the back and took a picture of just like the anti-influencer of like, this is what you're actually going to see if you get here. Sure, good, you can you, take man. Your picture with the arch, but this is what the world really looks like.
This is real life, people. This is how it is.
Man, Thanos say reality is often disappointing.
Yep. It's also stranger than fiction, so I don't know what you get when you combine those two things.
So
I've never been so surprised yet so disappointed in my whole life.
I'll maybe wrap up our topic for today with a closing thought from a book that I've been reading called The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry by author John Mark Comer. And he talks about this topic specifically in the sense of our finiteness as human beings and how we fight so hard to be infinite in many ways, where we try to be everywhere, to know everyone, to visit every destination, to try every food, to, you know, be good at every hobby, whatever it might be, and that we're just not capable of that. We're limited by space and time. And if we had 10 more hours in the day, we'd find 10 more things to fill up with, and we still wouldn't be achieving all that we want to do or all that we think society tells us we should do. And so his encouragement is that, as that quote from Jimmy John said, you know, the gap between more and enough never closes. It's basically, if you want that lifestyle, you can continue living that way. But the only way to escape that cycle in our culture is to slow down and be present in the moment and to enjoy where you are and who you're with and what you're doing, and to find the significance and meaning that you're seeking in those things, and just be content and not be looking to be, you know, winning or achieving or whatever it might be, but to consider achievement the enjoyment of the here and now. So it's a really interesting book. I'm curious to hear what more he has to say about it. But I think that's kind of the antidote to a lot of what we've talked about.
Great.
So with that all said, Sam, it was great having you with us. Appreciate you being able to join. And if you ever want to join again in the future, you're certainly welcome. And for those of our listeners who would still like the opportunity to be a guest, you're more than welcome to do that as well. We do have a link to sign up in every podcast episode description, as well as in our bio. So it just takes you to a Google form. It's a couple quick questions. You can fill it out, and we'll get you scheduled to join us. And as always, we're always looking for feedback as well. So if you have topics or ideas for improvement, we'd love to hear those from you. So with that, we're going to sign off for this episode. Thank you all for joining us, and we will talk to you next time.